Live from Beyond the Beltway, this is Bruce Dumont with our weekly analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by conservative commentator Bruno Barron, Republican attorney Josh Cantro, professor and good friend of this program, Mark Cello, and also a little bit later on in the program, we're going to be joined by the Libertarian Party candidate for President of the United States, Mike Turmott, will join us via Zoom, and we'll be taking calls and learning a little bit more about what the Libertarian Party is up to this year as well. And again, apologize at the beginning of the show. I'm still dealing with a little skin cancer on the face, so you see a few bandages from here and there. Hopefully they will go away. Happy Father's Day wherever you're listening. If your father is still alive, I hope you've reached out and said hello to him. If he's not, I hope there's a soft spot in your heart for him. And if you are a parent or a child, be sure to call your father. You don't have to send a gift, unless you want to, but you don't have to. Anyway, happy Father's Day. We'll talk about that a little bit later on in the program. In fact, I want to sort of kick off with this. We briefly discussed it last week on the show. And again, my question is Joe Biden a good father? Josh Cantro, I'm going to turn to you because I have said in this program, I think you're one of the great fathers based on what I read on Facebook with you and your kids going all over the place with skiing, enjoying a great recreational life together. But what's your take on that question? And is it a fair question?
I mean, first of all, I don't know because I don't know Joe Biden. But from what I see, he had a rough time. He lost a daughter. He lost his wife in a tragic car accident, which he unfortunately has lied about. He lost his son, Bo, to cancer. And he Joe Biden likes to claim that he lost Bo to the military, to a military action, which is just false.
Right.
But what we see with Hunter is troubling. I mean, it looks like someone who is quite just not there, and grifting and trying to take advantage and using drugs and all that. So I don't know whether Joe Biden's a good father or not, but certainly the situation with Hunter doesn't put Joe in a good light.
Mark Costello, is it a fair question to ask?
You know, I think it's a fair question. And, you know, for anyone in the audience who's ever dealt with addiction, it really changes people. And it's a lifelong thing. And for families who go through that, sometimes people are enabling, you know, they're loving. But then,
for the most part, it is agony for the family.
Oh, it's a lifelong agony. And to see Hunter come through that and be somewhat, not of his own volition, but taking accountability or starting to accept accountability for some of that pain he's inflicted on others and some of the graft and other things that Josh alluded to, I think is good. And Joe Biden, he loves his son. And he loved, he obviously loved Bo. He loves his children. I think that's a good thing.
Bruno Barrett, where do you come down on this?
I'm not qualified to judge Joe Biden's parenting skills or what he's like. I mean, he's been, you know, obviously he's been a very, very politically ambitious person from the day he entered law school, or if not, then sooner. That doesn't necessarily make a person a bad parent. He's had some kids. He's had some tragedies. He's had to come through them. So, you know, people can be, you know, I'm not a fan of Joe Biden. I don't think he's a particularly good president, but I have nothing to say negative about him as a parent. I can say plenty of negative things about his administration.
When you get into, to me, the most difficult thing about what we know about that relationship, and that is, by the way, Bo and Hunter were both left motherless at an early age. So they grew up together. There had to be a bond with the father, the daughter as well. And so they grew up. But all of the publicity, all of the adulation that Joe Biden put into his son, he put it into Beau, and Beau's political career moved miraculously through the state of Delaware. And we don't really know at this moment what he did to assist and boost Hunter. All we're hearing about now is where Hunter may have gone wrong. And again, I as a parent, I don't want to sit in judgment of him as well. But it seems to me that he's made some decisions. And when he says that, you know, Hunter Biden is the smartest person he knows, that scares the hell out of me. Because this is a guy, he's not a kid. He's a 50-year-old kid. He's made a lot of his own mistakes.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether the father has ever been there to right him, to put him on the right course. Clearly, there's a lot of unanswered questions about what he was doing when Joe Biden was vice president. We all want to know about what happened with Burisma, and also what happened with China and all the deals that the House is still looking into. But, you know, when he shows up at the House some night and says, "Dad, I'm dating Beau's widow," what does Joe say? Does Joe say that's okay? I've kidded a lot on this program.
Yeah.
What is a Thanksgiving dinner like at that house? But how do you answer that question?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know what Joe said, but we have certainly hints that there was enabling going on, and that there was that Joe thought that, okay, Beau can fly politically. He's an impressive guy, military, attorney general of Delaware, all of that. I'm going to help him that way, and I'm going to help Hunter financially. Hunter got in business with Biden Inc., which was really led by Joe's brother, James.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not this isn't stuff I'm making up as a partisan.
Right.
This is as reported by Politico back in as early as 2015, 2016. So to me, it all goes hand in hand. The grifting, the family business, they're trying to make money off Joe's government career, but Joe allegedly is not part of that, although that remains to be seen if that's really true. I don't think that you can really separate that from Hunter's other problems. That Hunter seems to me like someone who is entitled.
Does it make it difficult or almost impossible for the Republicans really to press the issue of Joe's or Hunter's drug issues? Because I think he can make Hunter and the Biden family sympathetic figures if the Republicans don't play it right, Mark.
No, absolutely, yeah. I think you know, Joe Biden's in this case has played it well. By focusing less on what Hunter has done and more on his love for Hunter, it's good optics at least.
I guess we should ask the question when we come back: has Donald Trump been a good father? We'll ask that one when we come back. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us. We will be talking about other subjects this evening, but happy Father's Day from coast to coast.
Kids want to share what's going on in their lives with the adults around them. Parents, grandparents, teachers, coaches, and more. They want to know you're listening, and they want to listen to you. They want your input and guidance, early and often, on all kinds of topics. When it comes to a serious subject like underage drinking, they want to know your expectations, as well as how and why, as a young person, they should avoid alcohol. How you talk about it will change as your child grows. But the important thing is to talk about it. Not just once for an hour when you think the time is right, but in 60 one-minute conversations and more that are part of your everyday talks. For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov. When you need me, I'll be by your side.
This is the story of a very special woman. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician or an entrepreneur. Her knowledge was limitless and still is. She could also make monsters disappear, especially those that lurked in the shadows under the bed. Once, this woman put back together a teenage girl's broken heart, which had been shattered in a thousand pieces, just by giving her a bear hug. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Dr. Nia Hergaris with today's tip for kids from the American Academy of Pediatrics. As parents, we want our children to grow up healthy and strong. That means helping teens take responsibility for their health as they become young adults. One way to do that is to make sure they have one-on-one time with their pediatrician. That helps them become comfortable talking about any health issue with their doctors and with you. So make sure to give your teen a voice. It's good for their health. For more on teen health, visit healthychildren.org.
I think it's just vapor.
Vaping is safer than smoking, isn't it?
There's really not even that much nicotine in them, right?
One vape pod has as much nicotine as one pack of cigarettes.
My kid
knows it's dangerous.
5.4 million American kids vape, and most think it's harmless. Get your head out of the cloud. Talk to your kid about vaping. Visit talkaboutvaping.org. That's talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back on Father's Day. We asked the question, to be fair, has Donald Trump been a good father? Bruno?
I mean, Joe Biden has lived a much more normal inside the rails, you know, inside the
Beltway
lines. Well, inside the normal lines life that Donald Trump has not. So you can make all kinds of comments about Donald Trump as a person. There's that song that Sting did in the 90s. I never liked the Russians. I always thought they're communists. The USSR was an evil empire, just like Reagan said. But the Russians love their children, too, right? Everything I look at, whether it's the estranged daughter or the older daughter or the daughter from this marriage or that marriage, he might not be a very good husband, but his kids seem to love him.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing that indicates that they don't. Look, his two sons are out there vigorously campaigning for him. They were there for him in the courtroom. His daughter was part of his first administration.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see any reason to think that he's not a good father. The husband is a different question.
Mm-hmm. Mark, Trump made it to Barron's graduation. He's doing it. And and his family's deeply involved for the most part in the campaign. Heck, they were the cabinet.
They made lots of deals.
They made lots of deals. But going back to Biden for a second, I think the one thing that's working against his good fatherdom is the grandchild Navy that they've never properly acknowledged. I do think that that's kind of a liability, and I think they should just go forth and embrace that child.
This past weekend, Joe Biden went to Hollywood. He flew in from Italy. He decided that he was not going to go to the last dinner out at the G7. And he flew in and walked away with $28 million. He's the bell of the ball in Hollywood. Donald Trump at that time was talking to Turning Point USA, Charlie Kirk's outfit, which was having a big conclave in Detroit. And he also spent some time dealing and campaigning in a black church, going after the black vote. $28 million is a lot of money, but is that an albatross around his neck, or is it just something to be proud of that you can raise that much money, Josh?
I mean, that's the reality of it. Good for him.
Yeah.
Under the current campaign finance laws, he raised a lot of money. Donald Trump has been raising a lot of money lately as well. within the existing rules. I think that, you know, a larger discussion is should the rules be changed, and that's for another day. But right now they're both playing under the rules. And so I don't have a problem with Biden raising that money. Now, I do think it's interesting that it comes from Hollywood, you know, and Hollywood is probably 90% behind Joe Biden and the type of people that he's raising it from. But good for him.
Bruno?
It's no surprise. Democrats raise a lot of money from Hollywood. What I think is interesting about the Trump running against Trump and the Democrats having a lot more money than Trump, I mean, they outraised Trump in 2016. They outraised Trump in 2020, probably by a lot. And Trump, never as much of a billionaire as he is, and that's probably something up for question as well, but right. he doesn't really feel the need to throw a lot of his own money into the campaign. But for whatever reason, Trump is one of those odd, strange populist. He's one of those populist presidents that just doesn't need as much money as Jeb Bush or Mitt Romney would need his base is his base, and if he can pick up another 4% or 5% above his base, he wins the presidency. If it's down to 3%, he doesn't.
Is it a cult, Mark? Do you think the Trumpsters are a cult?
I wouldn't say they're a cult. Trump's just really particularly good at branding, whether it's his opponents, himself. He's got a really clear messaging. I don't agree with his messaging, the message, but he's very good at messaging in a way Bill Clinton was. Those kind of simple, straightforward kind of everyman points. As a progressive, I don't like seeing Joe Biden out in Hollywood collecting all that money. It makes him look like he's the elites, and he's separated from, you know, flyover country and middle America. And, you know, he should be in Detroit. He should back in Detroit, but he should be talking about the auto industry, you know. He and Obama, when the Republicans wanted the auto industry to go bankrupt, they went in and bailed them out against a lot of people who said, no, we shouldn't do that, and we have a strong auto industry today. That would be the kind of thing I'd want to see Biden doing rather than out glad-handing Julia Roberts and Clooney.
One thing we've talked about a lot over the last several months is we've talked about the polls. I think there's been more news tied into the polls than any campaign I can remember. I think it's because it's such a long campaign, but we're learning about national polls, and we're also learning about battleground polls. And a surprising thing that I heard this morning on ABC is they quoted Nate Silver of 538, one of the great gurus of predictive politics in America. And he said that basically on the surveys that he's been taking, Donald Trump has recently switched. Donald Trump gets 51 out of 100 respondents. Joe Biden gets 49 out of 100. And in that interpretation by Nate Silver, who sort of knows this stuff, it gives Donald Trump a victory with 271 Electoral College votes, which is one more than you need. And I'm asking this collectively now. Does everybody at the table think this race is that close?
First of all, this is 5 months out, so we don't really know. The race may be close right now. I'm not so confident from the Republican side that it's going to be close in 4 or 5 months. What Bruno said was very interesting and I think true in that Trump doesn't need as much money to reach his base. But to get to the 3 to 4% of the undecided that's going to decide the election in the key swing states, that's going to take a lot of effort. It's going to take a real ground game, and it's going to take a lot of money.
But are you buying, and this is for everybody, are you buying the polls that have received the most media coverage, and that is that Donald Trump is winning beyond the margin in a significant number of battleground states, and that literally at this moment in time, the stories are that, you know, Joe Biden has to debate. Joe Biden has to be ready up at, you know, when the debate comes in a couple of weeks, and that it has created a narrative that the Democrats and Biden are gone, and if you watch Fox News, you think this race is over.
I don't buy that. Yeah,
I don't. Neither do I.
No, what I think is interesting about this race is, look, Trump is overperforming what people are guessing of him. I think that is mostly a function of an electorate that really does have the capacity to remember. You know, you had this COVID issue in the middle of it, and that was horrible for both, you know, Democrats and Republicans and the country. But the fact of the matter is, you look at Trump's presidency pre-COVID, and you had a 17% increase in household net worth after inflation, and then you have after COVID, you have the years of Biden where things recovered, and then you have literally like 0.07% increased net worth because of inflation. You have, you know, people can remember Trump's presidency, and they didn't like Trump, but they were like, yeah, the country was working pretty well. The country is doing okay at this moment, but if you look at some of the jobs data, we're actually bleeding, you know, full-time jobs, and we're getting a lot of part-time jobs. You've got, you know, when inflation goes from 17% or 12% or whatever it was down to 3.5%, that doesn't mean that inflation is down. That just means that it's not growing as fast, and everybody's still paying a lot more for their groceries. So if you look at those kinds of things, it's not that much of a surprise that Trump is doing as well as he's doing. And the Democrats have a little bit of a problem on their hand. But none of us at this table, nor these polls, nor Nate Silver, who blew it in 2016, I think, none of us can call what's going to happen because we don't know. And there's a lot of news that could break. There's a lot of things. You know, if abortion climbs as an issue, it works against Trump. If immigration climbs as an issue and it's the one climbing fastest now, then that works against Biden. So there's a lot of stuff that can happen between now and November.
Like insulting Milwaukee.
Well, I mean,
now again, the campaign said that he was talking about crime in Milwaukee, and he was talking about ballot security in Milwaukee. But the headlines and the way that the Democrats have responded to it, and the way that the media has responded to it, they've taken this crack about Milwaukee being a horrible place, and they blow it all over the place. So, I mean, and the Democrats in Wisconsin have already responded and put Donald Trump behind the eight ball on that issue.
And there's going to be a lot of that. I mean, Trump is a wild card, and stuff comes out of his mouth that isn't all that articulate at times. And, of course, the media, which is behind the Democrats, runs with it. So it's not just the money that he has to deal with, the fundraising advantage that Biden has, but it's the fact that the media is, by and large, in the tank for the Democrats. And so that's why I'm just not as optimistic about, like, the ultimate outcome of this election as the polls currently state right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I disagree. I feel like I'm a little worried about Trump's chances. I think the Democrats need to really get on the game messaging-wise and really find those golden spots in Biden's record and really run with those, and I'll tell you more about that.
We'll do that because you knew we're having a break. How about that? Even before the music, you knew. What happens when you've been on the show for 30 years or whatever it is. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thank you for joining us on Father's Day. Happy Father's Day if you are one. If you are not one, it's a real challenge. It's fun. Most of the time it's fun, but it is a challenge. I'm Bruce Dumont. Don't go away.
This is Hugh Hewitt for townhall.com. President Biden can continue to refer to himself as a friend of Israel, but in recent weeks and indeed months, he has not been that. He once was a solid friend of Israel. He is no more. You don't treat allies in an existential war the way America has Israel under Joe Biden. Yes, we have had incredibly difficult allies in all our modern wars. Every post-invasion government in Iraq, every government in South Vietnam, Charles de Gaulle, Chiang Kai-shek in World War II, for example, not to mention Joseph Stalin. The key rule about allies in wartime was enunciated by Winston Churchill, who loathed Stalin, but welcomed the then USSR to the right side when the Nazis invaded Russia. Quote, "If Hitler invaded hell, I would make at least a favorable reference to the devil in the House of Commons." Presidents do not turn against an ally they care about, especially one fighting for its life. Friends don't slander friends. The Biden administration, certainly no friend to Israel.
I think it's just vapor.
Vaping is safer than smoking, isn't it?
There's really not even that much nicotine in them, right?
One vape pod has as much nicotine as one pack of cigarettes.
My kid
knows it's dangerous.
5.4 million American kids vape, and most think it's harmless. Get your head out of the cloud. Talk to your kid about vaping. Visit talkaboutvaping.org. That's talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
Matthew.
Huh? Oh, sorry.
It's okay. I just need you to listen to me.
I know that a lot of times, Mom, it might not seem like I'm listening to you, but I am. I hear you. And what you say really does matter to me.
I mean, let's be honest. No kid likes rules, but I get why we have them. I hear you, and I know it's because you care.
All the talks we've had over the years, including what you've told me about not using alcohol and other drugs, they stick with me. And believe it or not, they really do make a difference, especially at times that matter most.
Hey, want a drink?
No, thanks, I'm good. So thank you, Dad, for talking and preparing me for what's ahead.
Thanks, Mom, for never giving up and always being my biggest fan.
Thank you for letting me know what you expect, so I can try to meet your expectations.
Thank you for talking.
For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Let's be honest. The National Symphony may not be in his future, but he wanted to try violin. So you said yes because you love him. And if you love him that much, love him enough to make sure he's buckled up and in the back seat. Find out more about keeping your kids safe in your vehicle at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Show them you love them. Keep them safe. Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Happy Father's Day, everybody. Nice to have you with us this evening. And Fritz, do you have those pictures that I sent to you? This is, I don't have many pictures. You know, growing up, I don't have a lot of pictures as a kid with my mother or father. It's just, we didn't take a lot of pictures. But this is a picture of me. I was about 3 years old, and I don't know how old my father was, but there he is. He had a little, I think, a questionable mustache at that point. It was the late 40s. I don't like that mustache. But that's my favorite picture of me and my dad. And, of course, being a father now, I have a daughter, and she's no spring chicken, but she's still beautiful, and I love her very much. That's Jennifer. She lives with her children in Southern California. I want to come back now and let everybody introduce themselves, as we generally do. Mark Casello, tell us a little bit about your Norwegian, and tell us about your a little bit about your dad.
Sure. I'm Mark Casello. I'm a chair of the humanities department at Calumet College of St. Joseph, and my father grew up in Chicago. Most of my grandfather on my dad's side's brothers and sisters were born in Italy, and so my father worked for CTA most of my life, the Chicago Transit Authority. Worked on the Red Line, fixing and maintaining the tracks, and was a foreman for the South shops on the south side of mm-hmm. Chicago. He also was he was in Korea right after the war had ended on the DMZ there.
Your interest in politics, did it come from either your mother or your father?
Well, certainly, yeah. There was definitely political talk in the house, and my father was very animated by politics. We didn't always see eye to eye on anything, and he was also an avid gun collector, and so he used to read the Shotgun News. Was one of his favorite publications.
Was he a Republican?
He kind of vacillated. He was pretty independent-minded.
Okay.
So he voted for Obama in the first term, but then really turned against Obama, okay. is what I recall. He was a Fox News viewer quite a bit, but he tried to consume lots of different media as well, but he would get stoked up by the issues he would see on cable news.
Josh Cantrell, tell us a little bit about your dad, and also a little bit about what you do when you're not here.
Well, my dad is just turned 84, and I'm very fortunate to be close with him and get to spend time with him. He's in good health and doing well. I'm originally from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and that's where my dad and my brother and sister live, and nephews as well. I did not grow up in a particularly political family in Baton Rouge, except for my mother's father. One of my grandfathers was well connected with the state's Democratic Party and with Edwin Edwards, who was a longtime Louisiana governor.
Right.
And my grandfather was a staunch Democrat. I went off to work 40 years ago, intern in Washington for summer for our local congressman, and I came back a raring Republican. And I had some, I remember.
You were working for a Democratic congressman?
For a Republican.
Okay. Who were you working for?
His name is Henson Moore. He's he's not in Congress anymore, but I actually saw him 3 weeks ago at a wedding down in Baton Rouge.
Do your relatives go back to Huey Long? Was that?
Oh yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
I'd love to hear those stories.
Yeah. So in any event, I had some really interesting discussions and debates with my grandfather, but toward the end of his life, he kind of got a bit more moderate, I would say.
Okay. Bruno Behrendt.
My dad's both my parents are post-war German immigrants. My mom came right after the war. She actually ended up marrying an American soldier, and then they got divorced, and she ended up going to where all the Germans hung out, and that was Chicago. And my dad came over in the early 50s because there wasn't much work and everything going on in Germany. He was studying engineering, so they met here. But I grew up in a very, very political family. I mean, my dad would talk politics all the time, and I got in my first political disagreement with him when I was 8 because he said he was going to vote Republican, and I thought that if you voted for a Republican, then we'd no longer be a democracy. And I didn't make the distinction between a Republican and a democracy at the time, so I was hoping the Democrats would win. But then by the time, by the time I got a little bit older, I was like more in line with all this stuff. And I voted first in 1980, and I voted for Ed Clark because I bought the Kool-Aid that Reagan was going to destroy the world. And by the time 84 hit, I was like, yeah, this is the way to go.
And was there German discrimination that your dad ever discussed?
My dad had both my parents had a pretty strong accent, which of course we never heard because we grew up with them.
Right,
so everybody was like, your parents have a very strong accent. We're like, no, they don't. But they did. And, regardless, I don't think they suffered anything like that. I mean, when I was born, it was only 15 years after the war had ended.
Right,
I was born in 60. So,
nothing.
And my dad passed in 73 and my mom at 73 in 2003 and my mom in 2013.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in a very political family. We talked about politics all the time at the dinner table. And I remember my dad would drive me to grammar school every morning, and before I got out of the car, we would sit in the front seat of that 1948 Plymouth, and we would listen to Paul Harvey on the radio. Mm-hmm. And then later that night, we would talk about what Paul Harvey had to say. And later in life, I had the pleasure of meeting Paul Harvey, substituting for him on a couple of occasions, and becoming very good in the latter part of my life. But it goes back to a situation of where, again, it was politics all the time. My father ran for office a number of times. He was almost a nuisance candidate towards the end of his life. But again, he was also very religious. So I grew up in a very religious family and a very politically conservative family. So I think if he were alive today, he would probably think I was a rhino or a left-wing Republican. Let's go to calls. Let's go to Dave listening to us in Washington State, way out west. Dave, go ahead. You've got some projections.
Hey there.
For
well,
us.
One of your guests mentioned drinking the Kool-Aid back with Reagan of not voting for him because the media scared him, and then realizing by 1984, nope, this is wrong. Similar thing could be brought up for Trump right now. I mean, the media trying to make Trump out both in 2016 is, if you elect him, we're going to be in World War III, And right now, the same kind of demagoguery going on for him. Mm-hmm. And enough people bought into that Kool-Aid at one point, which are now opening their eyes and being able to see through the propaganda of the media. That's what's switching a lot of this stuff and why I think he's going to win by easily more than 271. I think it's going to be in the 290s, even maybe low 300s on electoral vote, because mm-hmm. you have so many people. He only needs a little swing in some of the demographics like black people, right. women, all these areas. And he's already pulling more people, more of the black vote than he did previously right. away from Joe Biden, because these people are waking up. There's one guy that just mentioned, I'll just read it real quick, what he had said, that he's a venture capitalist, and he basically said that he drank the Kool-Aid and voted for Hillary and donated heavily to her in 2016 because he was so scared of Trump from the media. Mm-hmm. And then by the time 2020 came around, he realized that was wrong, but he was so disillusioned, he didn't vote for anybody. Now in 2024, he's fully backing Trump, and he wrote him a $300,000 check because wow. he's a big donor who used to donate very big to the Democrats. And he said in his ex post, he's ready to lose friends. He knows that, you know, some people are so into the Trump derangement syndrome, he's going to lose friends because of this. But he's looking at reality, and he's voting, was seeing through, again, the propaganda, both the omission and commission that the media does. And a lot of people in the country are in that same boat. Look at Tulsi Gabbard, who left the Democrat Party. Look at Kyrsten Sinema, who said, nope, can't take this. I mean, look at Joe Manchin. All these people are saying the Democrat Party is not the Democrat Party of old. I try and tell this to my father-in-law because he's just so Democrat in his head, he can only vote for someone if they have a D. And I said, this is not the Democrats of like John F. Kennedy. The party has left you, and you should leave the party. And that's what some of these politicians have done. That's why Trump's going to win big. It's going all the way across the country.
I want to hear your response to this question. But first, I want to hear from my guests in studio, Dave, if you'll bear with me.
And okay,
that
sure.
is a concern that I have, and I love this country, and I love talking about politics. I've been doing it for 44 years, anniversary coming up in a couple of weeks. I just absolutely love it. But I will tell you, I'm also very worried because of where things are in the country. I'm worried about what's going to happen to the losing side, whether I'm on the losing side, whether someone else is on the losing side. What is it going to do to the makeup of what life is like? I'm going to start with you, Bruno, and then we'll come back to you, Dave. I want to get your answer, but I want to hear okay. from our in-studio guest first.
I guess at some level you have to be hopeful, because if you're not hopeful and you just go by the trends that are going on right now, then whoever loses is going, their heads are going to explode and there's going to be some kind of riots. And I think the left is more worrisome along that than even the most fevered Trump people. I think the Trump people have already been through their silly mistake and overreaction with January 6th, and I think they might be like, okay, well, at least this one we saw coming and all this other stuff. So I'm just hopeful that people take a step back, and I would tell this to any Democrat. It's like, look, Trump was president for 4 years. The world didn't fall apart. No one died. And let the chips fall where they may and let this race run, and then just go back to being Americans.
Yeah, I agree with right. Bruno. I don't think the world's going to fall apart, but I am concerned about the left and the violence, and that we could see the summer of 2020 riots again, which, look, were much more pervasive than what happened on January 6th.
I want you to elaborate on that. I want to hear from Dave, and I also want to hear from Mark Costello, but we do have to break. 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to weigh in on that as well, the future of body politics in America. What's it going to be like? You pick a winner, we'll tell you what happens. Back shortly.
Visit Dennis Prager. Sign up today for an unforgettable experience in Israel this October. Mike Gallagher and I are traveling to the Holy Land on the Stand with Israel tour with our trusted partner, Inspiration Cruises and Tours. This trip of a lifetime to Israel is one you don't want to miss. Register today before it's too late at StandWithIsraelTour.com, StandWithIsraelTour.com, or call 855-565-5519, 855-565-5519.
I think it's just vapor.
Vaping is safer than smoking, isn't it?
There's really not even that much nicotine in them, right?
One vape pod has as much nicotine as one pack of cigarettes.
My kid?
My kid knows it's dangerous.
5.4 million American kids vape, and most think it's harmless. Get your head out of the cloud. Talk to your kid about vaping. Visit talkaboutvaping.org. That's talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
Why was the basketball court all wet? Because the players kept dribbling on it.
The dad joke. Corny, groan-worthy, but also one of the simplest ways to share a moment with your kids.
What did the buffalo say when he dropped his son off for school?
Bye, son.
So take a moment to make your kid laugh, because dad jokes rule. Make your kid laugh today. Go to fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
What if the music stopped? If the familiar voices were silenced? If there were no breaking news updates? What if your companion and connection to your community came with a monthly fee? Don't worry. We're free local radio with you wherever you go. Celebrating 100 years and looking forward to the next 100. We are broadcasters. Text radio to 52886 and let Congress know you depend on your local TV and radio stations. This message furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp. I can probably hit the green from here. Probably. Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Bruce DuMont back, and you wanted to make a comment before the break. Josh, go ahead.
Yes, I do. I do have concerns about the left and what will happen if they lose. If Trump wins,
only about the left.
I have concerns about the right as well. As you know, for the last 3 years, I've been very critical about January 6th. So, I mean, I'm not going to repeat those comments because listeners can go back, and longtime listeners know where I stand on that. But January 6th was one day, and I'm not excusing it. The summer of George was like 2 months of riots and looting and trashing businesses and cities across America. And then we see what the far left has done. And again, this is not all Democrats. This is not even close to a majority of Democrats. But the far left of that party, what they've done since the October 7th, when Hamas terrorists attacked Israel, has been taking over public spaces and making them inhospitable and uninhabitable to people that don't agree with them. So I am concerned that if Trump wins, we could see that sort of thing happening all across America again.
Mark Costello.
So the difference, I think, would be, and I'm not as concerned about a radical left overtaking that Josh was describing. I'm more worried about if you have, for example, Trump sweeps, you know, with a big electoral win, the Republicans retake the House, and now you've got the specter of a federal abortion ban or something coming. I think you'll see, you know, women rise up, like you had the Women's March after Trump's first election. Well, all of the things the women were scared of or fearful of have kind of come true now. We've got women's health has swung, you know, the pendulum has swung very far the other way. Beyond a woman's right to choose. And so I do think there's a potential there for some serious political unrest. And I think the Democrats really need to embrace women and really focus. And they've been trying to do that, but I think that's the...
Is there somebody out there, and I don't know where they come on the political spectrum, is there somebody out there that says, if you're on, you know, if you're on my side vis-a-vis abortion, we want you to go out there, work as hard as you've never worked in your life. Just go literally go nuts, standing for what you believe in. But if you lose, you know that you fought a good fight, but you've got to basically lick your wounds and acknowledge that the other side won. Is there anybody out there that can have that sort of psychological conversation with the body politic?
Well, actually, the two best people to do that would be Trump and Biden. Trump could do it. And if you listen, if you're reading between the lines and listening to his campaign, he's actually, you know, comment on Milwaukee or whatever notwithstanding, the fact of the matter is he's running a much more disciplined campaign. He has definitely moderated himself on abortion in going to the middle after the GOP is now starting to make mistakes with federal abortion bans, which I think is against the Dobbs decision anyway. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. But those are the two people who should say, just stop this stuff.
Okay. Dave, I want to go back to you to give the last word. What is your answer to the question or the worry that I have that we may be living in a world that nobody wants to live in?
Yeah, thanks, Bruce. I have similar worries. I mean, I proudly went in and served in the Marine Corps. I was a Marine Corps pilot for 12 years before I got out. And to see what's going on, just it really kills me. Thinking of the oath that you take every time you get promoted, just thinking about the people I served with and what an honor it was, and to see these polls where the pride in being an American has just dropped off so badly, which I blame the propaganda media and much of our college professors. The kind of things you see across these campuses right now is part of it. That's where I'm worried about the fate of the country, regardless of who wins this election, is that there is such just a cesspool of things that are affecting the country right now, which are really hard to control and get back, especially mm-hmm. with the college situation and tenure and all that. And it worries me because, I mean, my wife and I try and mentor people. We have a couple of couples that we're mentoring, and I fear for their kids. I mean, I've told them, gosh, I'm sad for you as far as any kids you're going to have. I mean, my wife and I did not have kids because I started seeing this coming in the 2000s, and I was worried enough about, like, Harry Reid and the things that they were doing. Too many people don't understand the tyranny of the majority and why having a supermajority required in the, to pass things through the legislature is important. And when you saw Kyrsten Sinema at least stand up and have some backbone and help the fight against getting that, done in this couple years ago, to where the Democrats wanted to just pass things through on their own. And too many people don't understand the ramifications of that. You get to a pure democracy and you have chaos. The country's trajectory becomes more like a roller coaster, up and down, up and down, up and down. You don't have any consistency in life. So I'm just worried about that perspective for the country.
Okay. Dave, listen, thank you very much for your question and comment and contribution to the broadcast. I appreciate it. One thing we also will realize is that regardless of who wins, we are likely to have the demonstrations on America's college campuses either continue or to become more violent. Because the one thing you didn't mention in your litany of things that could happen out there is we have this growing sense of anti-Semitism
yes.
on college campuses. And again, how you deal with that and how each political candidate and campaign deals with that is going to be quite, I think that's going to be a great challenge, because you have a significant number of people living in America who are moved and would like to exacerbate that issue. And many of them are demonstrating in the streets of college campuses now.
Yes, and those same people are the ones demonstrating against the police and against the establishment and all the other things, and who don't particularly love this country, I would say.
On that note, we're going to say farewell to our guests. We're not. They're all going to stay here. They're back for a second hour. And we're going to be joined by Mike Turmott. Mike Turmott is the vice presidential candidate of the United States for the Libertarian Party. He's going to join us for the next full hour, joining our conversationalists here in Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway this evening. Thank you very much for joining us in studio. We have Bruno Barron. We have Mark Casello. And we also have Josh Cantrell. They will continue with this, but our special guest is the candidate for Vice President for the Libertarian Party of the United States, Mike Termott. Did I get that right? Termott or Termott?
Termott, but if you focus on the Mike part, I'm sure that
Mike
Termott just fine.
Okay. We have done a number of shows with libertarians over the years on this program, Mike, and my question to you is, of all the issues that you and Chase Oliver, who is your presidential candidate, are going to be dealing with, what is the most popular issue that you think will cross beyond hardcore libertarians to a broader population of people who may choose to vote for you?
I think the number one issue is probably going to be war and peace, the idea that the United States has been pursuing a foreign policy that, frankly, neither aligns with most Americans' principles and ethics and values, nor does it align with good practices in terms of making us safer and spending money on things that most Americans would agree are in our strategic interest. So I think that is probably going to be the number one issue. I will tell you in advance, I am typically wrong in my predictions. So it may well be the case that economics, once again, you know, dominates the conversations. I think that our positions on inflation, for example, make a lot more sense than the other parties. And I think that we do a better job of talking about lowering spending and taxes.
What would you do about the Israel-Gaza war that's going on? Where should the United States be in that war? What should we be doing that we're not doing now?
Well, the right answer, of course, is to roll back a couple of years and extricate ourselves from this type of relationship that we have been pursuing in the Middle East with Israel, as well as a number of other governmental and non-governmental organizations in that area. But given where we are today, I think we need to pressure Israel into negotiating a settlement. And then we need to find a way to extricate ourselves from pursuing the kind of policy that we have been in the Middle East, which is to say, stop giving money away because it doesn't buy the American people a lot of influence. It doesn't make the region safer. It puts us on the hook for decisions made by other governments, in some cases, some pretty weird decisions that Americans don't like. And I think that we need to get out of the idea that we have allies that are intended to last forever, no matter what it is that they do. I think this is the wrong way to pursue foreign policy in general.
Should we then say to Israel, as I think President Biden has tried to say to Netanyahu, you do it this way or we're gone? Does it have to be that blunt? Because Netanyahu has his own political concerns. He's dealing with his own domestic politics. He's the one that's fighting to save his country from destruction. So are you suggesting that we pull the plug out totally from Israel?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I don't think there's a great option other than that. And I think that you put your finger right on the reasons for that. When you articulated it, you said he's got his own domestic problems, right? His own domestic challenges.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly right. They are his, and they are domestic to Israel.
Josh Cantrell was here. He's very active in the Jewish community in Chicago, and I know he's got some follow-up questions for you just on that subject, Mike.
Yeah, I'm not surprised to hear Mike say this. This has been the libertarian position before. It's fortunately a minority position in America. If you look at the polling, Americans across a wide political spectrum support Israel. They want the U.S. to continue to support Israel, and they understand what the U.S. gets back from having a democratic ally like Israel in the Middle East. So I'm not going to debate, Mike, on this, but other than to say that I guess, is he aware of polling that I'm not aware that this is an issue that would resonate with voters?
Mike? I think that the polls demonstrate that the backing for Israel is not anything even similar to what it was even a dozen years ago, number one. Number two, I think a lot of these polls are driven by the way that the questions are asked. I think that a lot of us, myself included, love the idea of backing Israel, love the idea of having a relationship with Israel. To many of us in the United States, this is a very personal issue. I have traveled Israel north, south, east, west. I've, you know, sent my son to train in the Middle East. He's traveled Israel. I've sent my daughter to events in Israel. I've traveled the Middle East with the kids beyond Israel. And by the way, that includes Palestinian territory. And for a lot of us, you know, there are faith-based connections to the Holy Land and all over Israel. This is a very personal issue. I get that. If you were to ask most Americans how you feel about Israel, you're going to get some fairly warm responses, from myself included. But there's a big difference, and I think that Americans are waking up to this idea. There's a big difference between how you feel about Israel, particularly how you feel about the Israeli people and the Israeli culture, and whether you find it an ethical proposition to be taking money away from Americans, including many of whom are among the least among us able to afford it, and using that to project our military influence around the world. I think those are two very, very different things.
Where are you on Ukraine, whether the United States should continue to provide funding to President Zelensky?
I think that we need to pursue and pressure a negotiated settlement there too. I don't think that there's a strong argument to be made.
Should we support giving land back? Should we support giving land back to Russia?
I think that we should be pressuring both of the sides in that conflict into a negotiated settlement. How that negotiation comes down is less important than having a settlement per se. It is not a major strategic matter for the United States people whether that settlement includes transferring land or not. I might have a personal opinion on that, but the idea that that is in the, you know, wheelhouse of what is strategically important to the United States, it's just not so.
Bruno
and I
Merritt?
Think it's important for us to recognize that, because otherwise we end up in the business of trading away things that really do matter in order to achieve a particular color of that settlement.
Bruno Behrend is here. He has frequently been identified as a libertarian, or the most libertarian person we've had on the program, but he sort of backs away from party participation. He's still more of a conservative than a libertarian. He's got questions. We're going to hear from him when we roll on. We've got a break right now. 1-800-723-8289. We're talking to Mike Termott. He is the vice presidential candidate of the Libertarian Party. We will hear from him when we roll on from Chicago.
As a local business owner, you get called every week by marketing companies. We get it. We have hundreds of satisfied customers. Here's what a satisfied client recently said.
Open enrollment is going great. We're hitting record numbers. Thank you so much for this report. It really is amazing to see how the marketing is really shaping our enrollment around the city.
If you're a local business and ready for the next step, visit SurroundChicago.com right now. Our experts are ready to help you take your marketing to the next level. Visit SurroundChicago.com today.
In the new video series, Fault Lines, Professor Vodi Bonkam examines the threat of woke social doctrine versus biblical justice.
The religion of anti-racism has no redemption. We have to be right about what God requires in this critical moment.
Discover the fault lines beneath today's cultural divide.
What God are you trying to appease?
Fault Lines, the 10-part video series and essential 6-part study guide. Available at SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp. I can probably hit the green from here. Probably. Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
This is the story of a very special woman. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician or an entrepreneur. Her knowledge was limitless and still is. She could also make monsters disappear, especially those that lurked in the shadows under the bed. Once, this woman put back together a teenage girl's broken heart, which had been shattered in a thousand pieces, just by giving her a bear hug. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back, and Bruno Barron has a question for you, Mike. Go ahead, Bruno.
So, Mike, first of all, congratulations for being on, and I found your answers to the questions that you got very articulate and a good exposition of the libertarian viewpoint. I worked a lot over the years at the Heartland Institute, primarily on school choice issues and things like that, but I could probably walk into any room and convince anybody that I was a rabid or a staunch libertarian or a staunch Republican or whatever. So, but here's kind of where my viewpoint has morphed, and I'd like to get your take on it. So I'll try and be really quick here. I think the non-intervention ideas are pretty good, and they make a lot of sense in some cases, but I became comfortable a long time ago with the fact that the United States is an empire. And I know libertarians don't like hearing that, but I think the facts are on the table that we are. And I also say that if we recede from trying to be an empire, it's not like Switzerland is going to fill the void and other nations will fill the power void. And that kind of makes me an unapologetic interventionist in some cases. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is I never have been, nor will ever anybody ever accuse me of being a social liberal. I've always been pro-life. A lot of libertarians I know are pro-life. But if you look at what's going on with the Democratic Party today, they're not just socially liberal, they're socially chaotic. And as time has gone on, this idea, the libertarian idea of live and let live, which, again, sounds really great on paper. We should all, you know, my rights stop at, you know, my fist rights stop at your nose and all that stuff. We all get that, and they make perfect sense. So the libertarians are a very, very doctrinaire good party on that stuff. But I've moved away from that. And so have a lot of other people, and that's why you guys are stuck at 3%. I'd like to get your take on that.
Mike?
Yeah, I appreciate all of that. I think there's other reasons why we're stuck at 3%, but thanks for suggesting that that's the only one. I'm glad to hear you say all that and the questions. Look, it is true that America is an empire. I don't think there's a lot of counter argument to that. I think you're right about that. I think you're also right that some people don't like to hear it. I don't like to hear it, but it's still true. However, I think that a couple things need to be borne in mind. One is that doesn't necessarily make it ethical. It also doesn't make it a good idea. You're right. Switzerland is not filling that void. But the implication of your question is that things have been going pretty well lately. And I think that it would be really hard to choose an American at random and say, I got 10 minutes, go ahead and list all of the military interventions in which we have been engaged since World War II that you think are a good idea, notwithstanding that it's cost us billions of dollars here or there, or thousands of lives here or there. Or in the case of Afghanistan and Iraq, trillions of dollars, and not thousands of lives, but over a million lives. I think it would be very difficult for most Americans to put their finger on something that has been in our strategic interest and successfully so, notwithstanding the cost. And so I think that while it is true that America is an empire, and at the moment, the only organization that can really lay claim to that, I don't think it's the case that we would say, and therefore the world is better off, and therefore we're safer. There are any number of opportunities around the world for us to be engaged in World War III fairly quickly. I think our attitude toward China is a complete mess. I think this idea of strategic ambiguity is walking us sleepwalk fashion into a conflict that is not in our interest. Parenthetically, it's not in the interest of the Chinese people either. I think that our attitude toward Russia has stunk for decades. I think that that is in no small part a contributing factor. And I know a lot of people don't like to hear it, but it's a contributing factor to the conflict in Ukraine.
Mike, I'm going to interject here only because I want to get Mark Costello and see if we can have maybe shorter questions and shorter answers so we can touch a lot more subjects. Mark?
So, Mike, honored to speak with you. I'm the progressive on the panel tonight. And when I think about libertarianism, there's a lot that can appeal to me. You know, as I'm watching these wars unfold, the real winners in my eyes are the military-industrial complex, the weapons manufacturers. I don't necessarily think that's making Americans safer or helping our citizens. But a lot of times the libertarian argument seems primarily economic to me. So what are the moral positions? What's your, you know, for example, students are out protesting, and a lot of times they get branded as anti-Semitic. But there's really a critique of the Netanyahu administration and the way this war is being prosecuted against the Palestinians. And so what is the libertarian position from a moral standpoint on how we're going to resolve that conflict? We've heard the economic, I understand the military aspect, but morally, as the libertarian ticket, what is your stance on the treatment of Palestinians?
Yeah, I appreciate you asking. Honestly, I think that every one of our positions is a moral one, and I say that because I'm an economist. And, you know, the way that we come at many of these issues is, you're right, from the right-hand side, which is to say, you know, how does the world work better because of it being less intervened by the government or less regulated, or, you know, people get wealthier if we do this or that. I realize that a lot of arguments move in that direction. But the truth of the matter is that every one of these has ethical underpinnings. And most starkly, in the case of Israel, the ethic at stake here is that it should not be for the United States government to be making this decision. I will answer your question in a moment, but the more important question really is, who is it that should be making this decision? Is it the U.S. government that should be making this decision? Why is it that we give aid to the government of Israel? This is a nation whose per capita GDP is something like 3/4 of that of the United States. Why is it that we are giving them billions of dollars every year? And this comes from someone who is, you know, very much pro Israeli people, culture, and in many cases, government, not at the moment. And so that's really the ethical failure, I believe, is the idea that it should be our government pressuring the Israeli government or anybody else in the Middle East or anywhere else around the world into doing something that we think is a good idea.
Mike, next subject, but I want to ask you about the open border with Mexico. Should the libertarians be elected, what would they do about that? Would they open it up or close it up?
We need to recognize that immigration is good for the United States, and we need a much more pro-immigration policy and a much more pro-immigrant policy. That means bringing people in faster. It means bringing more people in. But we all recognize that as a practical matter And as an ethical proposition, most Americans expect there to be some vetting at the border. The way that we do it today is dopey. We should be bringing technology to bear in order to make sure that people aren't on some list, right? There's not a felony warrant for you in your home country or anywhere else. And if there's not, we should be getting you into the United States and getting you to work. And by the way, this argument on the right-hand side of our political spectrum that we shouldn't be allowing people to work, I think, is absolutely backwards. It is counterproductive.
Are you worried about the terrorist threat that has been articulated by the head of the FBI?
Yes, I think all of us need to be worried about a terrorist threat. In this particular context, I am absolutely convinced that this is something that is blown out of proportion for political purposes. That doesn't make it unique. There's a tremendous amount that comes out of this administration and others that is exaggerated in order to gain political leverage. So it's not like I'm pointing the finger at this particular issue. But yes, we should be vetting people at the border. But this idea that you should come back for a hearing in a year or in multiple years is frankly silly. It's a bad look for the United States in terms of foreign policy, as well as in terms of building and honoring our culture of immigration.
Josh Cantrell, a follow-up question.
So Mike, I'm not completely clear on where you stand on the border, though. Is it that you just want people to come and be vetted, and if they don't have a criminal history, anybody from anywhere in the world can come in? Or does the United States have a right to admit a certain number of immigrants a year through a legal process?
The people, if you mean the United States government, no, the United States government doesn't have a right to do anything. The people of the United States do have a right to control our border, absolutely. But it needs to be said that it is in the interest of the people of the United States for immigration to continue. It's good for us culturally. It's good for us economically. It's good for us financially, as long as we don't do something stupid like pass out free money as people come across the border. I recognize that. And I do support the idea of there being vetting at the border, but that can be done a lot more effectively.
Do you support massive deportation? Would you support massive deportation?
No.
You would not cooperate with the government in deportation?
No, absolutely not. Deportation is a recognition. It's a silly response to a public policy problem that happened a long time ago. And let's be honest. I'm looking at the four of you guys. You guys strike me as having a lot in common with me, right? By the way, I'm from Chicago, so I need to put on my World Series hat.
Okay.
The five of us, I believe, would absolutely have run that border if it would mean building a better life for our families. I don't even want to poll you guys. I'm sure that that is something that you would do, and you know that I would do it. I would climb over your backs to get over that wall.
Okay.
Let's just let everybody out.
We've got to pause, Mike. When we come back, more questions, and we got some people on the line. They want to talk to you as well.
Video series Fault Lines, Professor Vodi Bonkam examines the threat of woke social doctrine versus biblical justice.
The religion of anti-racism has no redemption. We have to be right about what God requires in this critical moment.
Discover the fault lines beneath today's cultural divide.
What God are you trying to appease?
Fault Lines, the 10-part video series and essential 6-part study guide. Available at salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.
Dad, I picked up your pills, made your lunch, and your laundry is done.
When you care for a loved one, you take care of everything. But are you taking care of yourself? Find free care guides at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
This is the story of a very special woman. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician or an entrepreneur. Her knowledge was limitless, and still is. She could also make monsters disappear, especially those that lurked in the shadows under the bed. Once, this woman put back together a teenage girl's broken heart, which had been shattered in a thousand pieces, just by giving her a bear hug. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball!
Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp.
I can probably hit the green from here. Probably. Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Bruce DeMont back, and Bruno Barron, you wanted to ask a follow-up to Mike.
Yeah, first of all, Mike, for my long-winded question earlier, explanation, I think you answered the base of it very well, and it makes the basis of a good conversation, so I was fairly impressive, and I didn't even find myself disagreeing with that much of it. But then you had me and you lost me moment of typical libertarian ideology when you said the U.S. government, we were talking about the border, and you said the U.S. government doesn't have the right to do anything. And the fact of the matter is that's legally, constitutionally, and factually wrong. If there's one thing the U.S. government does have the right to do, whether they do it correctly or not, or bad policy or good policy, it's manage the border and how and when people come in. So I actually tend to agree with you about bringing people in is better than keeping people out. But I would also say that we've had 25, 30 years of doing this the exactly wrong way. And if there's one thing that I tend to agree with Trump on, it's that before we can even begin talking about managing the border, we have to make sure that we have control over who gets in and how, and then we can start talking about who comes in. So that was my comment on what you said.
Okay.
Mark, well, I appreciate that. I think it's important to recognize that we have a chicken and an egg at the same time. I wouldn't suggest that you have to get control over the border first. It is one of those things that has to be done. I would argue that you have to have a process in place to bring people in faster first. My comment about the U.S. government was merely one of semantics. The government of the United States, the federal government of the United States, is a tool through which Americans are able to exert their interests. The government itself doesn't have interests or rights. People do.
Well, I want to challenge you on being a Cubs fan, but you're from Chicago. Tell us where were you raised in the city of Chicago?
Oh, I'm sorry. I had my Ferguson Jenkins cup there. Let me put it down.
Okay.
I went to high school in Arlington Heights. I grew up in Des Plaines and Mount Prospect. My dad grew up in Cicero.
Whoa. A lot of political stories from growing up in Cicero.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
That's right. In those days, Mayor Daley was given to throwing machines in Lake Michigan if they didn't vote right.
Right. Mark Costello's here, who's got a comment.
Yeah, I was just following up on immigration. And, you know, one of the we don't have to relitigate the past interventionism of America in the United States and Latin America. But in your administration, where do you go in Latin America? Which countries do you focus on first? How do you start to untangle the knot that's created this drive of immigration to the U.S. Where do you, you know, I know you're not an interventionist, but policy-wise, which nations are you going to in Latin America? Which how is your attitude different and your policy different than the former administration or the Biden administration?
I do think that you can make great strides economically through free trade. I think you can make great strides economically by ending the war on drugs, by the way. We have a tremendous pull and undermining of various economies south of our Mexican border because of the war on drugs, which incentivizes the creation of black markets that are hugely dangerous. For example, we need to help the Mexican government get control over that nation rather than cede authority to what are essentially violent gangs ruling something like a quarter of the nation of Mexico. We can't have it. It creates havoc for them as well as an immigration challenge for us. I don't have a problem with great waves of immigration. It's simply not true that the United States is in some sense a packed nation that's overcrowded. So I think we need to be careful not to accidentally mischaracterize this as a challenge of having too much immigration.
So would your administration change their approach to Venezuela, for example, or Cuba or Iran?
Well, yes, if you mean absolutely. If you mean, for example, in terms of imposing sanctions don't work. We know that in terms of bringing about political change. This is an empirical matter, however you feel about the ethics. They just don't have the effect that, you know, well-meaning patriotic Americans all wish that they did have. They just don't. And so in that sense, I think that we need to unwind that. Whether that would be a silver bullet to get good government in some of these places, no, absolutely not. But there is no good reason to limit the growth of our economy because, you know, we somehow are wed to policies of either tariffs or sanctions or bans or something in the erroneous hope that that's going to bring about political change abroad. It just doesn't work.
We've got some callers. Let's go to them. Jeannie in Austin, Texas, listening on KLBJ. Go ahead, Jeannie.
Oh, hang on, Bruce. Hi. Happy Father's Day to all you men.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Yes. I've called in many times, Bruce. You know that. I'm a rock and roll singer here in Austin, Texas.
I know. You're a rock and roller from Texas.
Yeah. Living poor, though, hand to mouth, though, for sure. My family played last Friday, and we all got $33, you know, split it's insane. But anyway, I was going to let y'all know that I voted for Biden, and I'm a Latina. I voted for Biden. I'm not going to vote for him again. Not sure. I'm kind of leaning toward RFK. Biden is not in touch. Me and my husband, we have less than $1,000 in our savings now. During COVID, we had $11,000 saved. And so I just feel he's not in touch. He's just in denial. And it is groceries and, you know, just the inflation thing that everyone else is complaining about. It's real. All the videos on TikTok, all of that's real. I did like what the libertarian Mike was saying. I don't know who Mike is. I'm going to have to look you up because I'm not on the computer to see, you know, who's who. But I'm really digging what he was saying, and, like, I want to hear more of what he has to say.
I'm going to let him elaborate. He's an economist. He is a substitute teacher, and he's a former police executive. Where did you do your policing, Mike?
Not a police executive, a road guy. I was on the road for 11 years in Broward County, Florida, in southern Florida.
Okay.
Wow.
Is that like a state trooper? You were giving tickets on the highway?
No, I was a patrol officer.
Okay.
I was a police officer for one of the cities in Florida, responding call. It's a busy environment. It was the second career for me. I was a professional economist for more than a couple of decades. And to Jeannie's concerns, her perception of inflation is absolutely real. And although Jeannie sounds very young, she could be, you know, 200 years old, and she would recognize that inflation has been a problem in the United States for generations and decades and generations and decades. And I think it's time for us to admit And my fellow economists don't like to hear this, but it's time to admit that the way that we pursue monetary policy in the United States just doesn't work. Ethics aside, empirically speaking, it just doesn't work. It's time for us to replace the system we have now to strengthen the U.S. dollar. So, you know, we need to impose rules that say, no, we're not going to let the government or the Federal Reserve System issue as much money as it wants willy-nilly. This idea of having a discretionary policy doesn't work.
Do we remove safety nets? Do we remove safety nets?
I don't have a
for people that need help.
I don't have a problem with communities creating safety nets for people, but I think that I don't want to follow on a conversation about monetary policy with safety nets. You know, if the government stopped doing some of the dumb stuff it does, we would be better off. It would be easier to make ends meet, not harder.
We have Brian in the northwestern suburbs of Chicago has joined our conversation. Brian, go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Hey, I kind of want to talk a little bit about security. I was on a plane on 9/11, and the plane had to land. So when your libertarian says it's kind of blown out of proportion, it's not. It only took 19 terrorists to raise hell in this country. Second thing I do is I'm involved in the nuclear power industry, and there's major concerns about people coming across the border, about, you know, bin Laden wanted to attack a nuclear power plant, and believe me, Sandia National Labs has been looking into that, and that's something that, you know, we don't hear about. Mm-hmm. And lastly, the girl that just called, you know, that's great that, you know, you're looking at other candidates, but, you know, you have $1,000 in the bank. You know, I like Kennedy, too. However, he's not going to win. So it's either you vote for Biden or you vote for Trump. You either cast a vote to keep up with these policies that don't work, or you cast a vote and say, hey, we're going to look for a change, even though the guy's a jerk. Thanks for taking my call.
Okay. Thank you very much for calling. Josh.
Mike, I wanted to ask you a practical question. Under your administration, assuming that you win, you'd be dealing with a Congress that is either Democratic or Republican or a combination of both. How do you get anything done? How do you get anything passed in that kind of environment?
Well, it is hard. There's a lot that you can do, especially in area foreign policy, as you know, relatively unilaterally, not completely. There are also a number of things you can do to deregulate the environment. You can make a great deal of federal regulations subject to the approval of governors in their states, for example. There are also a lot of things you can do in terms of shifting resources around within the blob, as we say, inside the Beltway, in order to loosen the stranglehold of federal regulation mm-hmm. on our economy. Regarding working with the legislature in particular for those things that require legislative approval, there are things that you can do. You can threaten senators with closing bases in their states if they don't work with you in terms of peeling back foreign bases.
We've got to pause right now, Mike. When we come back, I want to elaborate on what you had to say about 3%, why the libertarians are stuck at 3%. Sounds like you've got an idea how to break out. I'm Bruce Dumont. Don't go away.
Matthew.
Huh? Oh, sorry.
It's okay. I just need you to listen to me.
I know that a lot of times, Mom, it might not seem like I'm listening to you, but I am. I hear you. And what you say really does matter to me.
I mean, let's be honest. No kid likes rules, but I get why we have them. I hear you, and I know it's because you care.
All the talks we've had over the years, including what you've told me about not using alcohol and other drugs, they stick with me. And believe it or not, they really do make a difference, especially at times that matter most.
Hey, want a drink?
No, thanks, I'm good. So thank you, Dad, for talking and preparing me for what's ahead.
Thanks, Mom, for never giving up and always being my biggest fan.
Thank you for letting me know what you expect, so I can try to meet your expectations.
Thank you for talking.
For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp. I can probably hit the green from here. Probably. Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and Ad Council.
This is the story of a very special woman. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician or an entrepreneur. Her knowledge was limitless and still is. She could also make monsters disappear, especially those that lurked in the shadows under the bed. Once, this woman put back together a teenage girl's broken heart, which had been shattered in a thousand pieces, just by giving her a bear hug. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back on Beyond the Beltway. Before we continue our conversation with the Libertarian Party candidate for vice president, there's another vice presidential nomination that's out there for somebody we've been kicking names around on this program for the last several weeks and months. Josh, it doesn't look like Nikki Haley is going to get the call. Is there any one of the four names? There's four names that are supposedly the hot four at the moment. J.D. Vance, Marco Rubio, Doug Burgum, and Tim Scott. No
to J.D. Vance and Scott. We don't need more MAGA people. We need to expand. I would still hold out hope that Trump would come to his senses and bring in Nikki Haley. That would be an incredible ticket. But out of the two that you mentioned, Rubio and Burgum, I have concerns about Burgum and some of the – North Dakota is a very conservative state.
Yeah.
And I have concerns about what the media would do and uncover to make him out to be some sort of right-wing, crazy conservative extremist, even though he's not. But they would have fodder to do that. Rubio is more well-known. He's an effective senator. He's a great attack dog on these shows. He's a mainstream Republican. Out of those four, that would be my choice.
Mark Casello.
Yeah, I think Trump really needs a woman on the ticket. I think Nikki Haley would be a good choice, but I don't know if he has that wisdom right now. But yeah, Burgum. I don't see Burgum as the candidate.
Burgum was on Fox News Sunday today. In fact, several of them were. Burgum was on. Tim Scott was on, and also Byron Donald. So I think is a long shot. He was on one of the shows as well. And I just think that the thing to me is that you have a lot of the vice presidential candidates. They're out. They're on the air. I thought that Tim Scott today hurt himself badly in answering questions about anti-Trump things he has said in the past, which could come back to haunt him. They all have something that could come back to haunt them, including Donald Trump. But I would say that the guy who's been working with him in preparing him for the debate is Marco Rubio. And I think that because Rubio is close, it has a key role, and they also flew back to Mar-a-Lago together when they went back to Florida. If I were to bet the ranch, I would bet the ranch on Marco Rubio.
Doesn't Rubio pose the same problem as DeSantis, where he has to, one of them has to, like, leave the state? I mean, it's a constitutional prohibition, but people are going to look at that.
I think that sources other than ourselves have figured out how to do that.
He could
run from New York.
Yeah, Trump could run from New York.
Run from New Jersey. He could run from a variety of places. But again, you think that DeSantis would be the best opportunity?
I think, look, everybody talks about, it should be a black person, it should be a woman, we have to balance the ticket, the Austin to Boston stuff that people have gone on with VPs all the time. It's like, just get the best person. And the best person, what I like about DeSantis, and I was a DeSantis guy, I always have been throughout this race. The fact is that you put that guy on there and you're telling the country, I'm dead serious about changing things. This guy is no shrinking violet. He's no Mitt Romney. He's no anybody. He goes after everybody and anything all the time. And then you get the comparison. Look at Florida. Look at California. Where would you rather be?
I like the idea also that in addition to having the ability to serve on day one, is that you want to look down the road and what do you want? What does Donald Trump want the party to look like 4 years down the road? I think because he likes J.D. Vance, I wouldn't be surprised with Vance. I think I would be surprised with the others at the moment. But he's got to remember that Marco Rubio ran against him, 4 years ago? It didn't happen. 8 years ago. Didn't happen. So he's been waiting his turn. He is little Marco. Mm-hmm. But, he's been around a long time. And I think something that you said, he handles himself well in network television interviews. He does not take the premise of the interrogator and just let them go with it. He challenges them that. And I think Trump likes that.
So I completely agree with Bruno. DeSantis was not presented as a choice when you asked me. But over Rubio any day. DeSantis, governor, successful. He's done it. He's implemented Trump-type policies successfully in Florida. He's turned a state that was purple into a reliably red state. DeSantis would be a fantastic choice. Still not as good as Nikki Haley, but he'd be a fantastic choice.
Okay. And we'll see what happens to Brian Donald. Because if Rubio became the vice president, DeSantis could appoint himself or his wife to the Senate, or he could appoint Byron Donald. Anyway, we're back to our Libertarian Party candidate. My question to you, sir, is what is the one thing people should... I need a 30-second answer here, Mike. What is the one thing people need to hear and know about you that you would be a heartbeat away from Chase Oliver, the Libertarian Party candidate for president?
Well, the first thing you need to know is Chase Oliver is a terrific and young man at 39 who is not going to have a problem keeping that heartbeat going. Number two, I was a White House economist. I've taught economics at 3 different universities. I've been a successful entrepreneur. And yes, I spent a lot of time talking about police reform, ending the war on drugs, and correcting our relationship to law enforcement because I was a cop as a second career.
30 seconds. How do you get beyond 3%?
You run a bold message and you wait for that tipping point. It was said earlier on your show that you've got only two choices. Not only is that factually incorrect, but as a pragmatic matter, if you look at a long game, you also have only two choices, and that is to vote for the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, and get more of the same that you've been getting for generations, or vote for someone else because they represent your values.
Mike, we got to say farewell. Mike Tremont, vice presidential candidate of the Libertarian Party, thanks to our studio guest. I'm Bruce Dumont. Also, thanks to Fritz Goldman for his assistance in the production of this Father's Day program. Good night from Chicago.